This is RN Breakfast, your world unfolding.
Good morning, this is AM, I'm Tony Eastley. There's growing consensus among world leaders that Syria is now heading for all-out war. The US Secretary of State says the situation is deteriorating and says Russia is fueling the chances of a full-blown conflict by refusing to support tougher measures at the UN. Meanwhile, Syrian authorities have completed an inquest into last week's massacre at Hula, which they say proves government forces were not to blame. Middle East correspondent Anne Barker reports.
2 days ago, the special envoy Kofi Annan was talking up the prospects of peace in Syria as he headed to a meeting with President Bashar al-Assad. But with the bloodshed continuing unabated and more bodies found at the site of another suspected massacre in Syria's east, all talk now has turned to the growing expectation of full-scale war. The UN Secretary-General Ban Ki-moon has spoken some of his strongest words on Syria since the conflict began. In Istanbul, he's warned that last weekend's slaughter at Hula, in which 108 people were killed, risks becoming a tragic turning point.
The massacre of civilians of the sort seen last weekend could plunge Syria into a catastrophic civil war, a civil war from which the country would never recover.
The UN chief has implored the Syrian regime to act on the commitments it gave to the April peace plan and ceasefire.
The United Nations did not deploy in Syria just to bear witness to the slaughter of innocents. We are not there to play the role of passive observer to unspeakable atrocities.
The US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton says the case for military intervention in Syria is growing stronger by the day, but she says Russia's policy of opposing tougher measures at the UN will only contribute to a civil war.
We have very strong opposition from Russia and China, but it's primarily Russia, and that makes it harder to put together an international coalition. The Syrians are not going to listen to us. They will listen maybe to the Russians, so we have to keep pushing them.
The BBC has obtained satellite images which show the location of Syrian army forces at Hula a few hours after last week's massacre. They show what intelligence analysts suggest was the firing point for Syrian artillery that shelled Hula and nearby villages, although the images don't prove conclusively the Syrian regime was to blame. And last night, a Syrian general, Qasem Jamal Sleiman, who led the official inquest into the massacre, repeated the claim that armed groups were responsible and not government forces.
About 600 to 700 attackers, armed men, came to the region. They used all weapons.
The Free Syrian Army, made up of defected Syrian soldiers, has repeatedly rejected such claims. One army member has set a deadline of noon today, local time, for Syrian troops and tanks to withdraw, or it too will abandon its ceasefire commitment and take new steps to try to overthrow the regime. This is Anne Barker reporting for AM.
Later today, Vladimir Putin will make his first trip to the West since his return to the Russian presidency. On his agenda are meetings with the leaders of France and Germany. It's expected they will push Mr. Putin on why Russia continues to support the regime of Syria's Bashar al-Assad. Moscow correspondent Norman Hermont reports.
Russia is by now accustomed to taking diplomatic body blows from the West over its staunch support of the embattled regime in Syria. But last week's massacre at Hula raised the battering to a new level. U.S. Senator and former presidential candidate John McCain firing the latest broadside.
Russian arms continue to flow into Syria. It is shameful that the United Nations Security Council should again be hindered by Russia and China by their vetoes for any significant action against Syria.
Even new French President François Hollande ratcheted up the pressure this week in an interview on French television. It is down to myself and others to convince Russia and China, said Mr. Hollande. The pressure needs to be applied as we speak in order to oust Bashar al-Assad's regime. In the days following the Hula massacre, even Russia itself seemed to indicate its rigid support for the Assad regime may be wilting, judging by the comments of Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. For us, it is completely unimportant who's in power in Syria, which regime is in Syria, said Mr. Lavrov. The most important thing for us is to support, above all else, an end to the violence. But many analysts in Moscow say it would be a mistake to read too much into those comments. Gaidar Jamal is the chairman of the Kremlin-friendly Islamic Committee of Russia.
Do you sense there are signs that perhaps the Russian government is softening its support for Bashar al-Assad?
I won't believe it. I think that Assad goes and Syria will inevitably go to the hands of the West. So it becomes a part of the anti-Iranian and anti-Russian front. It is absolutely unacceptable.
Could you foresee a scenario where Russia maintains support for the regime, but perhaps is prepared to let Bashar Assad leave? Something akin to what happened in Yemen.
I think for the regime it's the question of death and life. Where does he live? It is the question of survival. The Russian position, they cannot fall back. They cannot retreat from this.
It seems many in the Kremlin still believe the best way to maintain its influence over its last close ally in the Middle East is to keep betting on Bashar al-Assad. This is Norman Hermont in Moscow reporting for AM.
A 6-meter-long capsule splashing down in the Pacific Ocean has marked the successful end of a pioneering space mission. Dragon is the first privately owned spacecraft to visit the International Space Station. The billionaire founder of the company involved described the successful launch and recovery as the dawn of a new era. From Washington, here's Brendan Trembath.
The last minutes of this space mission had the same feel as many before.
This is Mission Control, Houston. Dragon continues its re-entry into the Earth's atmosphere. We're now 13 minutes and 23 seconds away from splashdown in the Pacific Ocean.
As Dragon hurtled through the Earth's atmosphere, the craft endured temperatures in excess of 1,600 degrees.
The NASA aircraft that is flying in a racetrack pattern around the splashdown site is reporting that they are beginning to pick up the first traces of Dragon on their infrared sensors.
The U.S. space agency NASA played a role in this mission, but the craft itself is privately owned and operated. The chief executive of SpaceX, Elon Musk, was tense as he monitored the mission from the company headquarters in Hawthorne, California.
It's just you can see so many ways that it can fail, and then it works, and you're like, wow, okay, it didn't fail. But I think anyone who's been involved in the design of a really complicated machine could sympathize with what I'm saying.
When the capsule splashed down off the California coast, Elon Musk was elated.
I'm just overwhelmed with joy for what's occurred here. It's been 10 years to have done this and have it go so well is incredibly satisfying. We look forward to doing lots more missions in the future and continuing to upgrade the technology and push the frontier of space transportation.
The South African-born businessman says SpaceX is planning the next International Space Station resupply flight and bidding for other NASA contracts.
For the remainder of this year, we're competing to to upgrade Dragon to carry astronauts. That's an ongoing competition, and hopeful that we'll win that contract. It would carry astronauts and it would also land on land and have the ability to land propulsively with the accuracy of a helicopter. So it's a significant technology upgrade as well. So we're really excited about that.
The company is venturing into space as cash-strapped governments cut funding for their own space programs. Though SpaceX, being commercially oriented, is interested in savings too. The chief executive, Elon Musk, says for the next mission, they can probably automate more functions and have fewer people in the control room. This is Brendan Trembath reporting for AM.
And you're listening to AM around Australia, where it's approaching 20 minutes past 7. You can follow us on Twitter if you like. Just search AM World Today PM. Christine Assange has rejected statements from the Foreign Minister, Bob Carr, that her son Julian has been given every available consular assistance in London as he faces court cases seeking his extradition to Sweden. Senator Carr says no Australian has received more consular support in a comparable period than Mr. Assange. Christine Assange, though, spoke to our reporter Samantha Hawley from London.
just one dismay after the other that justice can't be done on this case, but he's fighting along with his lawyers and people throughout the world to try and get justice. Because there's an abuse of process from day one, flagrant abuses of his legal rights, breaches the European Convention on Human Rights, breaches of the European arrest warrant system. If you were to wonder why he doesn't feel safe going back to Sweden, that would be your answer.
What's the worst fear about what would happen if the final appeal is unsuccessful and he is sent back to Sweden?
They have only produced this case against Julian as a holding case for a US extradition, and it's much easier to extradite him from Sweden than from the UK or Australia.
The US says there's no secret warrant.
Well, what do you want me to say? Of course they're going to say that. Of course they're going to.
In relation to the Australian government's response, it says it's giving Julian Assange consular assistance. In fact, Bob Carr, the foreign minister, says no Australian has received more consular support in a comparable period.
Well, I can understand his lawyers and what Julian are telling them, so they get absolutely nothing. They get the little stuff, you know, we'll sit in and watch the hearing. Now, I'll tell you that a number of things that the Australian government can do, which is what governments will often do on cases. One, it was asked the Australian government request that the Swedish government allow Julian bail if he ends up in Sweden, because if he doesn't get bail, foreigners don't get bail. Uncharged, unquestioned, he can go into indefinite pretrial solitary confinement. They've refused that. Secondarily, they've asked the Australian government, if Julian's appeal is successful in the UK and he can come home, would they create safe passage for him to come home? In other words, when the plane refuels in Singapore, can someone from the Australian government be there to prevent US marshals from pulling him off the plane and whisking him off to the US? They refuse that.
Everything that you've just talked about is hypothetical, hasn't happened.
What do you mean hypothetical?
Well, everything that you...
It hasn't happened yet. It hasn't happened yet, but we're worried about it.
Right, you're worried about it, but the government says it's giving Julian Assange consular assistance. You've agreed that they are, and that the Prime Minister says Australia can't...
Hang on a minute, I didn't agree that they are at all. I said they're giving him minimal stuff like turning up at hearings. They haven't given him any real consular assistance. To the contrary, they go on and on and on about all the other things that they've done to enable... What about the changes to the Extradition Act in Australia?
OK, well, the Australian government says it can't interfere in a judicial process in another country.
No, it's not. That's not true whatsoever.
At the end of the day, you think this whole process will end with Julian Assange in a US jail?
No, if we can help it. Not if 60% of the billions of people in the world can help it.
Christine Assange, mother of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, speaking to AM's Samantha Hawley. Qantas CEO Alan Joyce has been accused of misleading a Senate committee about his decision to lock out workers last year. The chairman of the committee, Labor Senator Glenn Stirl, says evidence given by the Qantas chief financial officer to Fair Work Australia this week is different to that given by Mr. Joyce. He says the Qantas CEO may want to correct the record. However, a Qantas spokeswoman says it's a simple misunderstanding, and neither the Senate nor the industrial court has been misled. Michael Vincent reports.
There's serious consequences for misleading a Senate committee. The chair of the Rural, Regional Affairs and Transport Committee, Senator Glenn Stirl.
My opening statement to Mr. Joyce, I made it very clear there are a set of standards and standing orders that it is a crime to mislead a Senate committee.
Senator Stirl says evidence has been given by the chief financial officer of Qantas this week at Fair Work Australia, which he says has revealed that a lockout was discussed at the executive committee level 2 weeks before it happened. But he says Alan Joyce told them the lockout decision was made by him only on the day it occurred.
The interpretation that I took as the chair of the committee was clearly the decision was wholly and solely Mr. Joyce's. And in front of that committee and my fellow committee members, we were led to believe quite clearly that the decision was made on that Saturday morning before the grounding.
But Qantas spokeswoman Olivia Wirth says there's no contradiction in either set of evidence.
I clearly think it's a simple misunderstanding, and I think that if one goes back and reads the 6 hours of transcript that the Qantas CEO answered, we did indicate that Qantas had always known that a lockout was an option. That's the case that the Qantas CEO made at the Senate inquiry. That's the evidence that Mr. Evans provided in court only a couple of days ago. One is a conversation, one is a consideration, and one is when the decision point was made.
However, the Transport Workers Union believes its lawyer has caught Qantas out in its cross-examination of the Chief Financial Officer. TWU National Secretary Tony Sheldon.
What's quite clear, and that is that the company said one thing to the Australian public, another thing to the Senate, in front of sworn evidence under oath, that they tried to give the impression that Alan Joyce mysteriously woke up one morning and as a fit of rage decided to shut an airline down. What's clear in this statement, that they had decided to shut down an airline 2 weeks beforehand. And that's quite clearly a tactic and a strategy that had already been put in place, and Alan Joyce had his finger on the button with every intention and a decision made 2 weeks beforehand to press that button.
And Senator Stirl, a life member of the TWU, wants Qantas to explain.
There's alarm bells going off, there's conflicting evidence. Someone has got their stories completely wrong. We've got to get to the bottom of this. Either the Senate committee's been misled or Fair Work Australia has been misled.
That report from Michael Vincent. This Sunday is the 20th anniversary of the landmark Mabo judgment in the High Court, but a lot of people believe the fight for full native title rights for Aboriginal people and Torres Strait Islanders isn't over yet. They're committed to changing a ruling made this year which found that native title rights don't extend to taking fish or other aquatic life for sale or trade. Reporter Natalie Perhernan travelled to Thursday Island, the home of the late Eddie Mabo, who was the guiding force for the successful native title claim 2 decades ago.
These women are singing in Meriam, the language of the Eastern Islands in the Torres Strait. It's the mother tongue of the most famous son of this region, Eddie Koiki Mabo. This weekend, islanders will be commemorating and celebrating his role in changing the landscape of Indigenous rights in Australia. The Torres Strait Sea and Land Council spokesman is Ned David.
It's probably the most important day in the calendar, I think. That's where, basically announced, our existence legally.
Eddie Mabo's decades-long fight through the courts to be legally recognised as the rightful owner of his traditional land continues to shape islander identity. Pedro Stephen is the mayor of the Torres Shire Council.
He certainly laid the first step for Torres Strait Islanders in actually giving us a very solid foundation about our sovereignty, about who we are.
While the Mabo judgment declared native title existed for Indigenous Australians who could show their connections to the land, islander leaders remain frustrated that 20 years on from the decision, the process for recognition remains complex and costly.
When the Native Title Act was actually implemented, the whole perspective of that is that the Australian government or the state and territory government says, okay, look, we know land management has been given to the states and territories. You blackfellas prove that you're from that land. And I think that when native title was identified, that native title does coexist, the approach should be vice versa.
But it's not the only rights issue affecting the region. In 2010, the federal court granted islanders native title rights in the seas of the Torres Strait, and that included the right to use marine resources for commercial activity. Ned David again.
It wasn't to deny or prevent external commercial interests. It was more about acknowledging the fact that we had a set of rights that included commercial interests that goes beyond any legislation.
But the Commonwealth government successfully appealed that decision in March this year, with the court finding native title rights didn't extend to taking fish or other aquatic life for sale or trade. Ned David says islanders are committed to changing that ruling and possibly taking their case to the High Court and following in the footsteps of Eddie Mabo.
We have a duty, I guess a responsibility, to make sure that we follow on or carry out the sort of work he left for us. And I think, we not only owe people like Uncle Koiki, but we owe it to our kids that are coming behind us, the next generation.
Ned David from the Torres Strait Sea and Land Council, ending that report from Natalie Perhernan. To finance now, and Wall Street has closed slightly weaker after the number of Americans applying for unemployment benefits rose to a 9-month high. The news cast fresh doubts on jobs growth in the US and the recovery of its ailing economy. The Dow Jones closed down 26 points, the Nasdaq down 10. In London, the FTSE finished the day up 24 points. The dollar is buying 97.3 US cents, 78.7 euro cents. I'm Tony Eastley, and that's AM for today.